Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, a weekly series of podcasts about happiness and work culture.
Hello again, I'm Bruce Daisley. This is episode 8 of Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat. You can catch up with all the previous episodes at our website. That's eatsleepworkrepeat.fm, sort of radio vibes there. Today's episode was provoked by an article in The Guardian just before Christmas. I've shared the link to it from our Twitter account. If you search for Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat on Twitter, you'll find that. And I've tweeted out the link. It was by a guy called Andre Spicer, and it was entitled "The Cult of Compulsory Happiness is Ruining Our Workplaces." Right then, because I guess if the premise of this podcast is that happy people are more productive, then the whole point of that article was really a challenge to my belief. So I went on to read it, and not only was it brilliant, but it inspired me to read Andre's other books. I mean, if you just hear the titles of Andre's books, you get a sense of the perspective he comes from. He says one of his books is The Stupidity Paradox, The Power and Pitfalls of Functional Stupidity at Work. And that's really about how we sometimes simplify things and simplify to a largely incorrect answer, but one that's easy to take in. He also wrote a book called The Wellness Syndrome, which talks about how we're being made to feel guilty for often unproven tweaks to our lifestyle. He's writing, he's sort of irascible and spiky, and I was just fascinated to meet him. I have to say, when I met him, I was worried that he was going to torpedo anything that we've discussed on these podcasts, and he was going to give evidence that really sort of disproved all of the ideas we had. Instead, it was probably my favourite interview I've done, and this is by far my favourite episode. So what you're going to hear in the next 30 minutes, we talk about a concept he calls geeksploitation. We talk about the pitfalls of open plan offices, lots more. I learned a lot of things that I think probably can really improve our working environment and our working lives. So I'll give him a proper introduction. Andre Spicer is the Professor of Organisational Behaviour at Cass Business School in London. He's also the Founding Director of Ethos, which is the Centre of Responsible Enterprise at Cass. He's an expert in organisational behaviour, in leadership, in corporate social responsibility. Man, I was kicking myself. What's the rule? You meet an Australian or a Kiwi, no one can tell the difference, right? So you always say to them, "Are you a Kiwi?" Why? Because the Australians don't mind correcting you, and the Kiwis are absolutely thrilled that you got it right. And what did I do? What did I do? I'm an idiot. I said, "Are you Australian?" Of course he's not Australian. He's Kiwi. Anyway, I went down to meet Andre about a week ago. Let's play the interview. I thought your work was really stimulating because of all the discussions I've been having to date, it's really the counterpoint to it. You know, I think the one thing that probably runs through all of my preconceptions and my imaginings before was to this Albert Schweitzer quotation that you gave, that, you know, he says, "Success is not the key to happiness. Happiness is the key to success." And so, you know, that's an interesting idea. You're more successful if you're more happy. And I guess that was my notion when I entered this. Mm-hmm. And your work really takes issue with that, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure. So if we look at kind of distribution of happiness, what we see, we know there's this curve which shows that basically up money actually does equal happiness up to a certain level, right? And afterwards it sort of plateaus off a little bit. But what we're trying to point out is this idea that if you somehow get to convince yourself and make yourself more happy somehow by hiring a life coach or doing mindfulness meditation or whatever intervention you might find, that you're suddenly going to become more successful in your life. Well, unfortunately, it's not the case. So there are many interventions which we see which try to aim at making people more happy. And often all it does is ends up making them feel either A, more miserable, or guilty that they're not being more successful. So let me give you an example of the more miserable. There was a really interesting study done, which was about maybe 10, 15 years ago. And some psychologists essentially gave people a piece of music, which should normally make either people quite happy. And they told one group, okay, listen to this piece of music and pay attention to how happy you're getting. It's a very happy piece of music. You should get happy by doing it. The second group, they gave them the music and just said, listen to it, right? And then they measured them before and afterwards about whether they were happy listening to the music. And what they found was the group that was told, pay attention to the music and make yourself more happy by doing it, actually became more miserable after listening to the music. And the other group who weren't told to be more happy became more happy. So what this begins to point towards is that if we're constantly told in our life, be more happy, focus on the good stuff in your life, la la la, what you often end up doing is missing the things which actually genuinely make you happy. So sometimes this over attention we give to happiness, I guess, draws out, it means that we end up finding the things which would normally make us happy actually end up becoming something which is embittering. Maybe that should have made me more happy or something like that. So that's the first point. The second point is this relationship between happiness equals success. What we've seen in the last, you know, like if we take the last 10 years, we've, you know, had the Great Depression. And one of the reactions, strangely enough, of policymakers, but also corporations, as they were firing people, as the government was cutting back on welfare, etc., was to say, okay, we're not going to give you anything, but what we can give you is a life coach. And if you can increase your happiness rating, then that's great. So it seems that people aren't willing to be given a pay rise or better work conditions, or in the case of government services, basic government services, we'll cut all of those things. All you get now is a life coach, and you get then a boost in happiness. And most of the time that doesn't happen. So it's just, and the weird thing is there is that if we take it back to the workplace, what we know is that the actual major causes of happiness at work aren't necessarily, you know, having an upbeat attitude, life coach, all that sort of stuff. It's actually just the design of the work itself, right? So do you feel like you have autonomy over your work? Is your boss, you know, fairly nice to you? Do you feel like you're doing something purposeful? Those things is what leads to happiness. It's not, do you have half an hour, one time a week to do some mindfulness meditation? So I think changing the structure of work is what's more likely to make people more happy, and then, you know, that might be good in some ways.
Right, so it's almost like happiness should never be the goal of the company. Is that what you're basically saying? Or it shouldn't be directly the goal. So you shouldn't be trying to do things. You should be more thinking, what are the components of the job that might correlate with people being more motivated, yeah, or happy, but don't set out to do those things.
Yeah. So the basic idea is that if you set out to get happy, it's likely you're going to end up more miserable. Often happiness is something which you find obliquely, right? So let's just take an idea that you're going to go for a walk, walk up to the top of a hill, and it's a beautiful day. If you're constantly thinking, how happy am I getting? My goal is happiness of walking up here. It's likely that you're not going to find that particularly happiness-inducing. However, if you say, I want to get to the top of the mountain, then it's likely along the way you might see a beautiful vista, and then you might surprise yourself, I'm happy here. The English economist John Kay makes this point where he talks about obliquity, so obliqueness. So we often achieve the greatest goals in our life, which might be, say, happiness, if we think that's important, obliquely, right? We find it. but by not expecting it. So maybe the times you've experienced happiness in the last, you know, week or so might have been not when you were planning for it, but it came about in another way, right? So I guess it's thinking about what would obliquely make us happy. And if you begin looking at a lot of the science on this topic, what you'll find is that stuff like commuting distance. So for instance, if your commuting distance goes over around about 30 minutes a day, your happiness ratings shoot down. It's things like work stress, having less autonomy at work. It's things like provision of public services. Also, like if you're in a very competitive environment, you're seeing other people around you who are far better or worse off than you, it's likely your happiness ratings are going to go down. So it's all of these things which aren't necessarily about mindset, but more the kind of context around you, which is likely to make you less or more happy. I mean, we know that, for instance, depression is one of the major drivers of unhappiness, and that's linked with all of these other things rather than just mindset.
And you touched on one thing there that I wanted to briefly cover on. So in one of your books, you talk about mindfulness, and we've mentioned mindfulness there. And I think, like you say in your work, you say that mindfulness has become this thing that we feel bad if someone tells us that they're spending time meditating, they're doing mindfulness. Yeah. We feel bad that we're not doing that. Yeah. And you say really explicitly, mindfulness is bad science. There's no correlation with mindfulness and any reduction in absenteeism or anyone feeling more fulfilled in their work?
Well, so mindfulness, there's actually a lot of research which shows mindfulness is good for certain individual level things, right? So anxiety, for instance, or ability to focus on a task for a significant period of time. Yeah, there's good evidence about that. Even for instance, in the one area I teach is in corporate social responsibility. And what we find there is that one of the only few ways you can actually change people's ethical orientation is to put them in mindfulness training, strangely, in a course. But if you want to say, okay, I want to transform my company as a whole by giving people an hour or half an hour of mindfulness every day, that ain't going to happen, right? There's not a lot of evidence for it. But there is evidence about individual level stuff, right? So just if I take myself, I'm at the end of just today handing in a large book manuscript and a very stressful time for myself and my co-author. And a few nights ago, I sat down and did 15 minutes of mindfulness, right? And I felt more focused and better and less anxious for it. But if I was forcing my whole company to do that, that's not necessarily going to mean the whole company transforms, right? So it's meaning that individual level transformations might make a difference for the individual, but it's not going to save your whole company. Maybe if I can just give you one small example of that. I remember sitting on a panel once where there was a woman from the Department of Health there. And the Department of Health is, you know, constantly going through changes and it's under huge pressure. And basically most people who are quite senior there are off on stress leave and so forth. So, you know, they have no control because the politician comes in charge and they change things all the time. And she went off on long-term stress leave. And then she came back and she'd found mindfulness meditation. It really made a difference to her life. Fantastic. But then she thought, okay, I'll provide this and people would go along after work. And that's also great. But then this idea that you can somehow completely transform a government department by introducing half an hour of mindfulness and an hour of mindfulness after work. So it means you're staying for an extra hour after work while still having an extremely stressful day. It's not going to happen. What you should do if you really want to make work more mindful is not add half an hour of mindfulness practice. Actually think about starting to make the work processes itself more mindful, right? So let me give you an example of that. If we think about, say, open plan offices, what that does, sometimes it's great for communication, but mostly data suggests that people just get distracted, they get more ill, they find them more stressed, there's more absenteeism, all of these kind of things if you have flex work desks or open plan workspaces, because they're getting interrupted. Now, if you do a survey and ask people, why did you have a good day today or not? This is what Harvard Business School did recently. The number one thing which comes out of people saying they had a good day at work is when they're able to sit down for some period of time and focus on a task which they found meaningful, important, etc., and make some progress on it. Yeah. It's that simple, right? And if you think about the way we design our workplaces, it's like constant interruptions, right? Emails all the time and social media and boss coming by and co-worker coming by and bugging you and another meeting you've got to go to and it's pointless. What if we actually thought about redesigning work where it gave us just a little bits of period of time we're actually able to focus on our work? And when you get into that and you know, if you see your work as meaningful, you then have this kind of flow state experience, which people kind of aim for a little bit with mindfulness. And hey, presto, you're actually finding your work as being a bit more focused rather than this disjointed and unconnected experience that most people have in the kind of workplaces we work in often.
Oh, fascinating. Well, that would, I mean, look, that would lead to a redesign of most contemporary office spaces, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we've been labouring under this illusion that the open plan flex work environment, you know, it looks like a kind of loft that's been taken over by some artists is the best way to organise stuff. No, most of the evidence suggests that open plan workplace is actually really bad, even for collaboration. There was a study that I actually had a student who was doing one at a study looking at a pharmaceutical company. And basically they had drug developers. One floor was like lab, where they had their own labs. The second floor, they developed open labs. And what they found is that basically the amount of communication between people when they developed this open lab was supposed to go up, but it actually went down.
Right.
So people they communicate less often when they're in open plan workspaces.
I wonder if it's because we've conflated hierarchical systems.
Yeah.
And so it felt like the big office was the sign of what the boss had.
Yeah.
And so because we've tried to break down those hierarchies,
yeah,
offices felt like what they needed to sacrifice.
Yeah.
So would that be consistent? I remember reading the book about Steve Jobs, and they were talking about Pixar,
yeah,
where everyone had their own environment, but there were a lot of social spaces that,
yeah,
were designed to produce accidental, you know,
exactly,
serendipitous connections,
exactly,
amongst people who'd previously been working on their own.
Yeah, exactly. So what you need probably in design of space, you need to think about providing different kinds of spaces, right? We're all territorial animals, right? Even to the extent that if I sort of started, grabbed your notebook over there and began flicking through, you'd get quite upset quite quickly, right? Even though maybe there's nothing bad in there that you wouldn't want to see. Why? Because it's your territory. And it's the same thing with workspaces. Even if you don't own the desk, someone coming into your workspace, unsettling it triggers really primeval urges in us. And we don't know how to deal with those things, right?
Wow. Okay. So I'm fascinated about that. The one thing that I really enjoyed that you gave reference to was this description of the early dot-com agency Razorfish. And you say,
yeah,
that they basically eradicated the distinction between work and home life.
Yeah.
And so that effectively people stayed all the time. You called it sort of geeksploitation.
Yeah.
Geeksploitation, I should say that
clearly. Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that, sort of why companies might have done that?
So I think companies did this for a range of reasons. One interesting argument, this is put forward by two French sociologists, is essentially what they were doing was copying a model which had been developed by left-wing social movements during the 60s and 70s and artists during this time, like the loft, and it's all free-flowing, lack of hierarchy, all of that sort of stuff. And people who they wanted to employ, they wanted that kind of workplace, right? They wanted to feel like they weren't at work, right? They just were doing this for a hobby and it was flexible and fun and you could bring your values to work and all of those kinds of things. And sounded great. But the weird thing is that what it ended up becoming was this boundary between work and home, which many people had fought against, including feminists, began to dissolve. Now, in some ways that was good because, you could bring your values to work and show who you really were and all those kind of things. But in reality, what that meant was that work bled into all aspects of people's lives, right? So they didn't know when they were at work and when they were at home. So now we have the experience where work, the first thing we do when we get up, we pick up one of these mobile phone devices and we check into work, basically. We check into our emails and see what's been happening. I think there's been surveys which suggest significant numbers of adults in the middle of the night wake up and they check their work emails, right? Which is crazy. So this idea that we're almost working in our sleep, to the extent that recently there was one computer coder we came across who talked about this idea that he began to do what he called sleep work, which was essentially dealing with solving computer coding problems in his dreams, right? Because it sort of bled into all aspects of our life. And the interesting thing to note then is that In many large corporations which have completely eradicated this boundary between work and life, let's say, the big problem they're sort of now sort of starting to ask is, how can we get into people's sleep or manage people's sleep, right? Because sleep has become such a the kind of the last barrier to work, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of
like Inception.
Yeah, yeah.
What you do? Right, amazing. Good. You mentioned one thing in the work that I read that was a survey by a supermarket that suggested that happier employees weren't necessarily the most productive, or that unhappy employees were often quite productive. And you also mentioned these other jobs where being unhappy pays off.
Yeah.
Negotiators
yeah.
tend to negotiate harder
yeah.
if they're miserable.
Yeah, exactly.
And so talk me through that supermarket work.
Okay, so it's worthwhile mentioning, just to back up for a second, this is a long-standing kind of issue in studies of the workplace. Is a happy worker a good worker? And if you went out on the street, we went out on the street and asked people, you know, is a happy worker a good worker? Most people would say, sure, yeah, it pays off if your employees are happy. Well, actually, what hundreds and hundreds of studies have told us over time, this kind of job satisfaction and productivity link, is there's a weak relationship, if there's a relationship at all. So there's kind of a little bit of a tick, but it's fairly, fairly weak, right? And the reason for that, there's actually a lot of studies which shows that sometimes the relationship is opposite to what you expect. So, for instance, there was a study of Tesco's supermarkets, I think it was, and they looked at happiness ratings and job satisfaction ratings in a number of their supermarkets and looked at productivity levels. And what they found is that the most productive of the, I think it was warehouses actually, the most productive warehouses had the most miserable employees, basically, which you know suggests it's probably not so fun working there. But there's also research to suggest that, yeah, happiness is important. Having happy workers is important for some kind of jobs. Like, let's say a service job or client-facing job. You know, you don't want to deal with too many miserable people. But there are certain jobs where having someone who's upbeat and joyous all the time is not so good. So, for instance, air traffic controller. You don't want a super happy air traffic controller. Same thing with, as you mentioned, negotiators, that often negotiators who are a bit angry sometimes often get the best outcomes. And the weird thing is that even artificial intelligence is beginning to learn this. So I noticed last week that Google's artificial intelligence it's begun to learn in its negotiations. It pays off to be angry and evil sometimes, because you sometimes get the best outcomes rather than being nicey-nicey all the whole time. So I guess the point here is that for many jobs, having just focusing on happiness as one discrete emotion is probably problematic, and you actually need to prompt a range of other emotions. The final thing I kind of just add on to this, it's really interesting to see what more broadly about the debate of this, many of the experts around happiness are beginning to say, well, happiness isn't the only thing which counts. Actually, one of the major things that people go in their lives more generally and also at work are looking for is not necessarily feeling happy all the time, but it's actually a sense of meaning. Right? So we seem to be seeing this movement from kind of happiness to meaning. And often those two things aren't particularly correlated. So there's often jobs that people might do that don't make them particularly happy, but they often find it extremely meaningful, right? So in many ways, the question which we might ask ourselves is not necessarily how do you make people happy at work, but how do you make your work more meaningful?
Right.
And the way to do that, I think, I mean, the recent psychological literature suggests that to make things more meaningful, you need kind of three factors. Number one, what they call kind of, it's basically being able to understand what's going on. Like, what's the story of my career history? What's going on here at work? And people who feel like they're able to describe a fairly coherent story of their careers, of their lives, and also of their organizations, that's meaningful for them, right? The second thing is they have a clear goal or end purpose or value which matters to them. And that's not maximizing shareholder value. It's doing something which, you know, has a value. So, you know, for me, it's educating students and doing research and communicating my ideas. For maybe someone who works in the health sector, it might be, you know, making people well again. For maybe someone who works in a bank, it might be helping their clients. So a broader purpose that they find meaningful. And then the final thing is, does that purpose actually matter, right? Making a sense that what someone is doing on a day-to-day basis really mean something, right? So if you think about, say, a cleaner in a hospital, cleaning up people's excrement at hospital is probably not the most fun thing. But you're then, if you think about that as caring for someone, and we know that one of the most important things in having good healthcare outcomes is cleanliness of a ward, right? It's 10-20% of mortality rates. That's meaningful, right? Versus just if you're, doing a cleaning job and there's no purpose and no meaning around it, then you begin to think my job is meaningless. And it's the same thing with middle managers, even high-level executives. If they feel like what I do doesn't matter, then it's hard to keep going at work, basically.
Yeah. What strikes me about all of the things that you said here is that there seems to be so little intersection between people like you who study and try and understand what works, and then all of the idiots running around doing jobs in the real world. You know, look, you know, the open office space doesn't seem to work. You know, trying to make people happy doesn't seem to work. And yet, meanwhile, out there in the wild world, there's people saying, let's take all the walls down in here. Mm-hmm. Let's, you know, buy everyone smoothies on Wednesday afternoons to make them happy. And there seems to be like no connection. How can academia and forgive me, the real world, how can they intersect more meaningfully? How can they intersect better?
Okay, so one way to start answering that question is from the opposite side, which is to say, you know, I work in the middle of the City of London. This place is an organisation, indeed acts like a business many times. And universities have increasingly come to sort of style themselves on the corporate world, to the extent that they've started to develop all of the same kind of nonsense things, time-wasting activities that most people complain about in the corporate world, that Lucy Calloway, for instance, writes about all the time in her, you know, pointless rebranding exercises, strategies that don't mean anything, meetings which go on forever and ever, et cetera, et cetera. So it's the same kind of stuff. So I think there's something there that you know, that universities have kind of slowly been taken over by these sort of things. The second thing is then about how does ideas which are generated, you know, in universities but elsewhere actually engage with the real world. I think it's sort of people see it as partially about a kind of a communication thing, because most of the time, you know, if I pick up one of these journals which, you know, we write for like this. You know, if I read two lines from it, you're like, what does that mean, right? So there's a question about the language and the way it's communicated. But I think also there's a sort of, there's a sense that often the ideas are disconnected. They need to be embodied into a practice or something which can be done, or a model or a recommendation or something like that. So it's about experimenting with new ways of living and doing and those kind of things. I think that's kind of, and many, some people do this. So for instance, if you look at the example around sort of why ideas about happiness have become so popular, there's a whole field called happiness economics, which has sort of boosted it to the top of the agenda. And it takes 5 or 10 years' time for it to sort of have an influence, if you like. If you take the example of open office stuff, it's only in the last 5 to 10 years a lot of this evidence come out. And architects, bless their souls, they tend to, you know, if you look at their models, they have computer-generated people there. Mm. And they just about never go back and say, what happened afterwards, right? So it would be lovely if they might begin to think about, well, these are these imaginary people, but then there's actually people who need to work and live here. What would our architecture look like if we really took those people into account?
Yeah. Mm. It's interesting though, isn't it? Because I bet you if they go back, they'd say, do you enjoy your office?
Yeah.
And people would go, yeah, it's lovely.
Exactly.
But they wouldn't actually then ask themselves slightly more reflectively, exactly, do I get a lot of work done here?
Exactly. And one of the biggest trends, if you look at kind of work dynamics at the moment, is people either working in these co-working spaces or working increasingly at home, right? And part of the desire to use these types of spaces is the rise of kind of gig economy, that sort of stuff. But also part of it is that people find that when they go into work, they get nothing done, right? Work is where you go to get nothing done. And these other places are sometimes where you can actually be productive, right? Which is kind of peculiar.
Yeah, fascinating. The one thing I wanted to ask at the end really was, when you're advising people, when you're talking about these things, what do you advise companies to focus on, leaders and people to focus on? Is it about cultivating a sense of purpose? Is it about the environment that people work in? I mean, and you also talk in your other work about the avoidance of sort of simplistic and reductive answers. So I know I'm asking you to give you me something simplistic.
Okay, so I think if we take the example of like the basic idea, which we often have, which is convince yourself that you're happy, look for the positive things, take an upbeat perspective on life, and then success will follow. If you look at most of the evidence from psychology, it tells you that humans are weak, right? Changing your mindset might change your behavior very slightly, but you're going to revert backwards. If you actually want to change your behavior, the best thing to do is to change your environment around you, right? So if you want to lose weight, don't try and convince yourself and mindset. Go and take all the fatty foods out of your fridge. Make sure that you have to walk to work, you know, force yourself to do that in some ways with your environment, not changing your mindset. So I'm very much of the opinion that we need to think about ways in which you actually change the environment around people, which would then prompt good behaviors and whatever that might be. So for instance, if you want to make people happy at work, begin to design their jobs which are a little bit more autonomous. If you want to make them more mindful, give them a little bit of space where they actually can focus on a task. If you want to them to feel like their work is meaningful, don't sort of just tell them, yeah, this is super meaningful. Provide them with ways and purposes and actual meaningful work, right? Opportunities where they can develop a meaningful career which sort of links together over time. Give them work which matters and explain why that's the case and give them opportunities to do that. The same thing with often organizations spend a huge amount of time developing kind of taking smart people and essentially stupefying them. It's a disaster. So what you need to do is to think, how can we ensure that these smart people actually use their brains? And one of the ways you can do that is to appoint people as, say, be a devil's advocate for the day. You know, your job today is to be a naysayer, to question stuff. And what we know from a lot of psychological research, if you have a group of people and, you know, everyone pretty much agrees, like first person agrees, second person agrees, third person agrees, fourth, five, and six are going to agree as well, even if they think it's wrong, right? So if you then have that group, first person agrees, second person agrees, third person agrees, fourth person says no, and they might be wrong, it's more likely that even if they're wrong, the fifth person is going to come up with the right answer because at least someone's questioning it. So organizations have lots of PAs, personal assistants. Maybe we need a few more DAs, devil's advocates, whose role it is to call people out and to ask critical questions. It might upset people every now and then, but at least it will kind of get people thinking a little bit and asking a few kind of questions in some ways.
It also feels, from what you said there, I mean, I love what you said there, because I've always had this sort of suspicion that we become our building that we're in. Yeah. We become a, and you know, and it just feels like such a ridiculous thing to say, but you can have one company that moves from one building to another.
Yeah, yeah.
And this, often you normally upgrade, don't you? But you move from, but some unexpected consequences happen along the way.
Yeah.
And what it makes me feel like, the very fact that you say our environment in every single way has a contributory factor to the outcome, but it makes me think to some extent that you almost need, as well as like the boss creating a strategy, you almost need like a conductor of like these exogenous factors that thinks about, okay, we need a space for people to work here. Yeah. We need people to be thinking about the meaningful aspects of these things.
Yeah.
Someone who's sort of system thinking as well as doing the strategy for a company.
Absolutely. Because often, I mean, the interesting thing is that sometimes strategy is completely disconnected with these actual day-to-day things. So sometimes strategy documents are about providing direction. But a lot of the time they're about convincing the analysts in a financial market firm that this looks good. And the percentage of strategy which is actually delivered in firms is probably quite small, I'd say. So I think, sure, do strategy. We all need to do it. Gives meaning, gives direction. But maybe you're right that there needs to be another kind of question, which is about sort of asking what's actually going on here on a ground day-to-day level and how can we make that sort of slightly more meaningful and better for people in some ways.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door.
Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
What a legend. Definitely my favourite Kiwi. Andre was absolutely magnificent. What I'm intrigued by, you know, is that a number of the academics I've spoken to have said really similar things, you know, that we need to, one, minimise interruptions, get into this sort of flow state. Two, you shouldn't try to aspire to make people happy at work, but you should try to aim to inspire people by the job they do. And meanwhile, companies are just focused on frivolous things or benefits and perks, which just seem like night and day away from giving people satisfaction at work. And, you know, the tragedy is the job of building office walls doesn't seem to be likely to happen in, certainly in my working life. I was chatting to someone the other day saying, you know, it turns out having little offices and compartments is a good thing. And they said, yeah, our bosses have got them. No, that's not what we mean. We don't mean offices as a status symbol, as hierarchy. We mean everyone should have little cubbyhole offices. I mean, maybe it just wouldn't work out. Maybe it's not for the best. Maybe it's not for this life, Bruce. Don't dwell on it. Anyway, so good. I've really enjoyed that. And I've got some really good episodes coming up. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to hopefully broaden things out. So there's going to be a mix as we go through the spring. But over the next few weeks, I should be talking to a lot of people who really understand teams and building teams. And that might be teams who work in restaurants. It might be military teams. It might be sports teams. It might be writing teams. So I've got a number of those coming up. But I'm really keen to hear your ideas too. So you can tweet me. Just drop me a line. Send me your thoughts. I'd really appreciate it if you subscribe via iTunes. New episodes drop on Monday. Good. Thank you. I am so properly thrilled you listened. I'm Bruce Daisley. Come back next time and I'll provide cake. Cheers.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.